Falls are a very common cause of injury among older adults, but there are ways to prevent or lessen the risk. Our physical therapists are back with us today to talk about some of the latest research on falls. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. We have Jill Tine-Nissenbaum and Lori Tine-Brody on the phone with us. Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Jill. How are you?
I'm well. I'm happy to say that.
Good, yes.
Yes, and Lori is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Hi, Lori.
Hello, Jill. How are you today?
Well, and yourself?
Good.
Yay. Yep.
No complaints.
Good. Have fall slips or trips been a problem for you or a loved one in your life? Is it something that you worry about? Do you have any other questions for our physical therapist? We'll join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. So what's been going on with you guys as far as COVID goes? Lori, I know that you see patients all the time or used to. What's going on there?
I personally am not seeing patients right now.
Okay.
I've been redeployed to the hospital, but we are in the process of ramping up our warm water pool for physical therapy patients in the pool. Some of my colleagues here are seeing patients face to face. We'll have about 4 therapists in-house on any day using appropriate, you know, personal protective equipment. We have all of our chairs in our waiting room spaced. We've made the place safe to start to see patients again.
Okay, good news. And Jill, what about you? Has anything changed for you?
Oh, yes. So I teach at the university. That's half my job. And of course, we're doing everything via video, and I'm lecturing from my own home. The first time I lectured live, I accidentally scheduled my 12-year-old daughter to practice her trumpet at the same time. That did not work too well.
Okay.
We will have students coming back in at the end of June, early July, to do some hands-on testing, because as you know, with physical therapy, a lot of what we do is hands-on.
Right.
So we completed the didactic coursework, and they will come back in for hands-on stuff prior to hopefully going out and doing their clinical internships. And then with regards to the athletic department, we are doing a lot of Zoom discussions. I'm in constant communication with the athletic trainers, who are in constant communication with the athletes. And they've started doing a few elective surgeries at UW again. And so we've had a few athletes who have had surgery who are kind of in the queue waiting for surgery. So we have a few postoperative patients that we're seeing right now as well. But like Lori said, we're doing everything extremely cautiously, minimally. Patient selection is very important. Temperature taking, things like that.
Okay, great. Well, it's glad to hear you're sort of getting back to the way things used to be. Kind of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Slowly.
Very slowly and cautiously.
Which is the right way to do it.
It is,
so
absolutely.
We just want to make sure everyone is safe and healthy. Mm-hmm. That's really important.
Excellent. Well, we are going to start off our conversation today by talking about falls. And it does happen to older people, although I have to admit I've been falling since I was born. I just never stopped. But why is it that older people tend to be more prone to falls?
Well, you know, speaking from personal experience, our mother fell and sustained a subdural hematoma. So falls hit very close to home for us. There are a number of reasons, and there's no one single reason. It's multifactorial, which is what makes it harder to treat and harder to pin down. Sometimes it's vision. Sometimes it's hearing. Sometimes it's a loss of sensation in your feet. Sometimes it's weakness. Oftentimes as people age, they don't move as quickly as they did when they were younger, so their responses are not as fast. So it's multifactorial. There's no single reason for it, but a combination of all these things.
And the other one that Lori didn't mention, but is also very important, is medication or a combination of medications can also cause dizziness, lightheadedness, things like that, which may also play a role. So like Lori said, you can't really just fault it for one specific thing.
So then I would imagine then trying to prevent falls, you have to come at it at a sort of a task force area then too, right?
Right, exactly. So, you know, when someone has been having issues with falling, it's one of our standard screening questions. When we see any new patient, regardless of age, we ask them if they've fallen in the past 12 months, because your history of falling is one of the best predictors of a future fall. So keep that in mind. If you have fallen in the recent past, you are at risk for another fall. So then we would screen them for all those factors. As Jill mentioned, we look at their medication list. We do a series of tests to test their balance. Unfortunately, as some research that Jill and I discussed shows, a lot of our tests that we use in the clinic don't necessarily discern who's going to trip and fall or who will sustain a fall that has an injury. But there's some of the tests that we use to see, you know, what's your sensory, what's your reaction time, and so on. And then we typically design a multifaceted program for that person.
And there's definitely multidisciplinary clinics that focus on falls prevention, and they try and come at it from every angle. So they may have nursing on board, a physician on board, a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, to address all the different components that could be contributing to a patient's falls risk. So because it is so multifaceted, multidisciplinary clinics are a really good strategy to try and prevent falls. Unfortunately, Wisconsin ranks very high in our prevalence of falls per state. At one point, we were number one. I don't know if we still are.
So approximately, this data was from 2014, 2.8 million people were treated in emergency departments for injuries. 27,000 people died because of a fall, 800,000 hospitalized at an estimated cost of $32 billion to the healthcare industry and individuals falls-related expenses. So it is a very big problem. And here at UW, when we talk about what our overarching goals are, one of them is always falls prevention. That comes to the top of the list every time. So we look at our environment to see if there's anything in our environment that's contributing to risks of falling. And that's another thing that a multidisciplinary clinic will look at, is not only the individual, but also their environment. Are there things in their environment that place them at risk of falls? Lighting, rugs, the structure of your home, hand railings, position of furniture, so on and so forth.
Something as simple as a change in a surface. If you go from linoleum in your kitchen to carpet in the next room, and granted it's a low-level carpet, but something like that, in a patient who doesn't clear their foot very well or has some weakness in their leg, could be enough to cause them to sustain a fall.
Or even footwear, I would imagine.
Footwear is very important as well. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So then what is, as physical therapists, what are some of the things that you specifically would do for someone to help them if they were falling a lot?
Well, the first thing is to figure out if there are any obvious underlying impairments that are contributing. So do we need to involve the physician because the patient is over-medicated? Do we need to have somebody go into the home to do an environmental analysis? In the clinic, we do a number of things. We do strengthening. We practice sit to stand. We do strengthening exercises. We do mobility exercises. And then as the person improves, one of the things we move on to is what's called perturbation training. And that is we try to disrupt their balance and teach them how to regain or restore their balance. And we put them on uneven surfaces. We have them step over things. We have them step on surfaces like foams and cushions and things like that that are unstable, and have them practice maintaining their balance.
So that change in terrain or that change in surface, this is one way that we can train it, as Lori mentioned, is truly trying to change the surface that the patient is stepping on or moving on to more simulate those changes in surfaces that they may experience in an environment.
So it's not necessarily preventative, although some of it is, but it's also recovery if someone is in the process of falling.
Yes, it's having the reflexes and having the ability to fire their muscles quickly. It's one of the things I alluded to at the beginning, which is as people age, they tend to move more slowly and they lose what are called fast twitch fibers. Your muscles are made up of various fiber types, slow twitch, fast twitch, and as you can imagine, the fast twitch are the ones that react quickly. And so as people age and they stop moving quickly, those fibers tend to atrophy. They're not used as much. And so to call on those fibers in a quick reaction when you lose your balance, they're not there. So one of the research papers we looked at this perturbation training, and they found that people who underwent this training had a decreased risk of falls compared to what's called a standard treatment group in the first 3 months. But importantly, they also had a significant decrease in falls that resulted in injuries. So even though some of these people in the perturbation group did fall, they had fewer injuries than the other group. So you're right, Jill, that decreasing injuries and having some sort of a response to protect themselves in a fall was important.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones. They're all full. We have lots of questions. But first one is Richard in Two Rivers. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I worked for 30 years in physical therapy. I retired last year, and I was blessed and had the opportunity to work side by side with Florence Kendall.
Oh, wow!
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You're speaking our language. Amazing.
She wrote the book on manual muscle testing. She's a goddess in the physical therapy world.
Thank you for explaining that.
Yes, absolutely. She wrote a textbook that we're on our fifth or sixth, and it's a standard textbook in physical therapy education and PDA education. Sorry.
Yeah, she's the most beautiful person I ever met.
Yeah.
But there's several factors that you have been addressing that are key importance in helping with the preventing falls. And the first one is flexibility, and specifically in the hamstrings and the heel cords. And the second one is strength, and that can be addressed with closed kinematic chain exercises. And probably the most important one is body awareness between the mind and the limbs. And Tai Chi will teach you how to do that depending on your level of physical ability. And by connecting the body with the individual movements of each extremity, it'll allow the brain to reconnect itself to the body movements, and that can be practiced in everything in the house, from doing dishes to vacuuming and everything else. And I can take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Richard.
Well, he brings up some great points. And so flexibility, he's referring to flexibility in the hamstring and the gastrocnemius, which are the muscles on the back of the legs. And if they are tight or inflexible, it makes it difficult to swing your foot through when you're walking. So he's absolutely right. We need adequate flexibility there for leg clearance as we walk forward. Then the second thing he mentioned was the closed chain exercises. Closed kinetic chain exercises mean that your feet are on the ground and you're moving around those. So Lori had mentioned doing some chair exercises where you go from sit to stand. So a squat exercise would be an example of a closed chain exercise. And he's right, that's a great way to strengthen because it's extremely functional for patients. And it, with our feet on the ground, it gives us that added proprioceptive input. And then the third thing he mentioned was Tai Chi, which is absolutely fabulous. It is one of the best exercises or movement activities for individuals who are looking for to increase their proprioceptive awareness, or as Richard referred to it, the kind of mind-body connection, knowing where your body is in space. It's very slow and controlled, and it can be easily adapted to many different levels of ability. So Tai Chi is a really nice training tool. And as a matter of fact, one of my colleagues here at the UW-Madison Physical Therapy Program does research in physical therapy and Tai Chi.
So it's important to be aware that particularly for older people in a traditional Tai Chi class, many of the Tai Chi movements are on a single leg. And while that's great for retraining balance, it can wreak havoc with your joints. So if it's something you intend on trying, I would find an instructor who can modify that for people who have arthritis or other problems with their lower extremity joints, hip, knee, arthritis, ankle, feet, foot pain, whatever. There's also I Chi, which is Tai Chi in the water, which is another nice way to do that because it decreases the weight bearing on your legs. And in terms of falling, if you lose your balance, the water slows that down and you have an opportunity to regain your balance. So it's another way to become aware of where your body is in space, as Richard has suggested, in a lower risk environment.
And yoga is another version of that too that is helpful for balance, isn't it?
It can be. There's lots of yoga poses that are single limb or come with a very wide stance. There's a lot of yoga that you do on the floor. So it would be something that if you were at risk of falls and you wanted to practice very specific yoga movements, that would be one of those things where I would definitely consult a physical therapist and make sure that those movements are productive and not putting you at risk of a fall.
Okay. Well, you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tyler Ditter is our technical director today, and Natalie Guyette is our on-air producer. Well, we are talking about preventing falls with our regular physical therapists, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you could always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go right back to the phones because we have someone who has experienced a fall, Linda in Fond du Lac. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Yes, last Tuesday, I was going downstairs and missed the last step. I fell on my knee, and the knee is, I still have a little bit of pain. It was very, very painful when I first fell. My concern right now is starting on Friday, I got pain in that foot. Mm. And was when I got out of bed in the morning, I had pain on the bottom of my foot. And it's been that way every morning, and it doesn't last real long. I usually put ice on it, but the veins on the my ankle is a little bit swollen too, not terribly, but a little bit. And the veins on the top of that foot are more prominent than on the other foot. And I guess I'm kind of worried about maybe there's kind of a nerve that maybe went down that leg. I don't know.
It sounds a little more, I think you have reason to be concerned. It sounds a little more vascular to me than nervish. Would you agree, Lori?
Yeah, it does. Do you remember what position your foot was in when you landed? It sounded like you fell forward.
I fell forward.
And
correct.
You landed on your knee. But what position was your foot in when you landed?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I think it was kind of up in the air a little bit. I mean, yep. If I landed on my knee, I didn't have any pain in my foot originally.
Okay. Did you, when you landed on your knee, was it in all the way in flexion, like deep, deep kneeling? You know what I mean?
oh boy, I landed on my knee and deep kneeling. No, okay. It wasn't pulled all the way back. No.
Okay. I was okay.
All right. I mean, my guess is she was, I don't even know if she was in dorsiflexion, but you had no pain in your foot at the time, and you got up and walked away, and then it was 3 days later on Friday you woke up with pain?
Correct.
And it's in your, is it in your arch? The arch of your foot, you said?
No, it's more in the bottom of the foot, and then in the, and it can also radiate to the top of the foot, too.
When you say the bottom of your foot, where do you mean on the bottom of your foot?
By the heel?
By the toes?
No,
in the middle?
It's in the middle. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So she could have had a midfoot sprain.
Yeah, well, yeah. A couple thoughts I had were, do you feel like you're limping at all? I was wondering if she gave herself just a little bit of acute plantar fasciitis, but it doesn't sound like plantar fasciitis to me.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like
at first. I'm limping a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. Were you barefoot?
The knee is still, you know, a little bit painful.
Sure. Were you barefoot when you fell?
Was I what?
Barefoot. Did you have shoes on?
I had shoes on, yes.
Okay. Well,
chances are our foot was probably protected then.
Right. Exactly.
So is it getting better, Linda, or is it getting worse?
The pain in the foot?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about the knee? Like I said, I wake up in the morning and it's painful. I've been putting ice on it. And then probably within an hour or so, it's hardly any pain at all. Or I would equate it to like a very mild toothache pain. You know, just a real mild.
And then as the day goes on, does it still stay better or does it get worse again toward the end of the day?
It stays better. I don't notice it until I wake up in the morning and put weight on it.
Okay. So the weight, the first thing in the morning is a little uncomfortable, but once she gets going, her day goes okay.
And if you've been sitting down, if you sit down to watch TV or have lunch and then you get up and move again, is it sore again?
Yes.
It still sounds plantar fasciitis-y. I wonder if she has been favoring it and it was just there waiting to declare itself after the fall.
That could be. I mean, that could very well be. That was my first thought was, is this due to her change in her gait a little bit? Did she just give herself a little bit of plantar fasciitis?
So give yourself a little bit of time. See how it plays out. You can try some stretching for your calf and for the bottom of your foot. So if you what foot is it?
Left.
So if you take your left foot and you cross it over your right knee and you bend your toes up or back towards the front of your calf to stretch the bottom of your foot, try doing a little bit of stretching like that and see if that plus the ice over the next few days gets better. If not, go in and have it looked at to make sure that you didn't cause some damage to your foot when you fell.
Okay, thank you very much for the call, Linda. Good luck with that. Having just got off of a bout of plantar fasciitis myself, I don't envy you at all. Let's go next to Chuck in Hartford. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
I have a bed that's many years old, and it's got like a spot in the middle now. And I'm wondering, what is your guess? Think about a new bed. Should I get a regular spring bed or should I get like a foam one, or what's the thinking on beds that are healthy for the back and stuff like that? Because my low back and my mid back, especially the pelvis, just kill me when I get up in the morning.
Well, I think you said yourself it's time for a new bed.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are pros and cons to each. So there's no one bed that's right for everybody. So start with that. And I'd say the number one thing is looking at a bed from a place that will give you a warranty. Like, you take it home, you try it out for 30 days. If you don't like it, we'll come and pick it up and take it back. Because it's really hard to tell how a bed is going to be until you lay on it and sleep on it for a few nights. So, you know, typically we look for something that's, you know, relatively firm. There's a lot of places that have the foam mattresses now that seem to be a good fit for a lot of people. Jill, do you have any other thoughts? I mean,
no,
to me, the best thing is the warranty.
The guarantee, yes.
Yeah.
I agree with that, because it's hard to lay on a mattress for 10 minutes and say, yep, this is going to work for me. So I think trying many different ones out, discussing at the store wherever you go, or if you call them first, kind of what you're looking for is very helpful. But I do think that guarantee is really important. And then the other thing that we learned from this show was the flipping of the mattress, or the spinning and rotation of the mattress, and how important that is early on in the purchasing of a mattress. And is it every month?
Every month for the first 6 months, you're supposed to rotate your mattress.
Yeah.
Yes,
so
and then you should flip it over. After that, it should be at least like when the seasons change, so four times a year.
Well, you know, the thing is, a lot of the mattresses now will have that
pillow top,
pillow top on one side. So flipping it over doesn't always work. So those would be the questions I would have wherever I went. I'd go to some place that had both the spring mattresses and the foam mattresses and get some advice on what are the pros and cons of each of those. And then trying them out and making sure that there's a guarantee, and then doing the rotation and or flipping as you can. But yeah, clearly sooner before your back gets any worse.
For sure. Well, good luck, Chuck. That's almost as actually, you should probably put more time into choosing your bed, your mattress, than you should choosing a car. Because you spend more time in it, right?
You do. You spend a third of your life in it.
Exactly.
So, absolutely.
Exactly. Okay. Well, let's go on to Faye in Milwaukee. Hi, Faye.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I don't have an issue with falling, but I have an arthritic left big toe. Oh. Now, I've gone to a podiatrist, and I have, over the last 3 years, gotten maybe 1 to 2 shots a year. And I'm thinking, I love going to physical therapists, but because I've had such great results from it, but it's never been recommended that I could do physical therapy for this toe. And I'm just wondering if that is something I could do. And there, of course, is surgeries, but that is just scary.
Yeah.
I don't want to go there.
Right.
But
yeah.
What could I do? Is there stuff that they could do for this?
Well, typically, arthritis in the big toe is first of all, it's relatively common, and second, there's not a lot that physical therapy does for that specifically. What we tend to do is look at the entire foot and see if there's any recommendations we can make about shoe wear, about different inserts in your foot. Typically a shoe, for example, a shoe with a rocker bottom or a bit of a heel lift will help, because you tend to not have enough extension in your big toe. I'll typically give people some self-mobilizations for the big toe to see if they can gain any more mobility there, or at least maintain the mobility that they have so that they don't lose any more. Jill?
And the other thing is looking to see if you can steal any motion or mobility from anywhere else in the foot or the ankle. Sometimes you can pick up a little bit of dorsiflexion. The challenge with the first MTP joint is it's kind of the last joint in the chain. And so with walking and things like that, you can kind of modify and steal motion until you get to the end of the chain. And after that, there's not a lot of options per se. But having said that, people don't realize how important first MTP joint mobility is, because if you're lacking motion there, it can actually impact your entire gait mechanics and go all the way up the chain and cause low back pain. So I think it's probably worth seeing a therapist and seeing if they have any ideas or suggestions. And if you could find somebody who specializes in foot and ankle, that would be great.
Okay, thank you for the call, Faye. Let's go on to Christine, and she's in Madison. Hello, Christine.
Hi. Hi. So the reason I'm calling is I have multiple sclerosis, and my balance is pretty appalling in general. But and so often if I start to fall, I can't recover. But the thing I've had going on lately is I think one of my right foot is sort of not flexing up as much maybe anymore or dropping down a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm catching my toe, and I've taken two really bad falls in the last couple of months. And I find that I'm just walking more and more cautiously, almost to the point of not wanting to be outside. And I'm wondering if there are physical therapy exercises. I know there are devices that you can put on the foot that stabilize it and keep it from flexing. I'd love to not have to go there. But I'm wondering if there's some physical therapy exercises I could do to really kind of strengthen that maybe ankle or whatever it is that
right. So what you're talking about is it's called dorsiflexion, or pulling your toes up at your ankle joint to clear your foot when you swing through. And I guess my first question would be, you said you're noticing that it's getting weaker. Is there a reason that you think it's getting weaker? Is there some sort of contributing factor?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if it's getting weaker. I just think I notice more that I'm catching that foot. So I'm guessing that I'm not picking it up enough, or it's not sort of other, you know, I can sort of, it's one of those things like if you try to practice or make sure you're lifting your foot, you start to walk like Frankenstein.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's hard to say if this is just a progression of the disease or if there's something else going on. But yes, practicing, as Richard said, actually, at the top of the show, this mind-body connection. So you don't necessarily have to exaggerate the lifting of your leg or your foot, but really thinking and concentrating and making sure you're pulling your foot up as you walk to try to maintain that connection. So that's the mind-body part. And then the strengthening is, you know, if nothing else, just standing and practicing that motion over and over again within the framework of avoiding fatigue because of your MS. Just the lifting your knee and dorsiflexing at the same time, so those motions happen together. They're part of a motor program that happens together. So the strengthening and the mind-body awareness. So, and then we do see some patients in the pool working on balance exercises there because of the controlled fall that happens in there.
Right.
All right. Great. Thank you, Christine. Appreciate the call. Next, we have Martha in Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Hi. This is a interesting topic. My dad, who, God rest him, is gone now, but back in the day, he was falling a lot as he got elderly. And at one point, he had his doctor's appointment, and his regular doctor was out. And he saw a young geriatric specialist who, when looking over his chart and reviewing his falls, said simply, "This is unacceptable. Elderly people do not have to fall. And we're going to go in and really take a good look at this case and eliminate your father's fall." And he did. Most of it was due to medication problems, but they also had someone come to the house and watch him walk. And he had a live-in care person. And this person was trained in how to help him walk and increase supervision, change of medication, and just supervision and guidance in getting around the house was able to eliminate his falls. So I think a huge discussion needs to be that the doctor must simply not accept this. And this young doctor did not accept my father falling, and thank goodness he didn't. So there's just, you know, one case where we had success.
That's a great story. Sorry, Lori. And I agree with you. Falling is not part of the natural age-related process, and it is preventable, and we should be doing things to prevent people from falling, and it shouldn't be, oh, I fell, oh, that's no big deal. I don't think people always appreciate the negative sequelae that comes with being a frequent faller.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, and often symptoms in certain categories of people are dismissed as, oh, that's normal for you and your whatever your group happens to be, and I think it's appropriate to ask whether or not that's actually true.
All right. Well, Martha, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Appreciate that. Let's see. Up next, Lynn in Black Earth is with us. Hi, Lynn.
Hello?
Yes. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling about my my mother, who lives in her own home, and she's 87, and I am worried about her slipping in the bathtub. She, you know, as far as putting a bath mat down with those little sticky suction cups, she can't really bend over and, like, lift that up every day to dry it. And so she's reluctant to put something down there that's going to just stay down there and stay wet, which I agree with. So I'm wondering, do you guys know of any, like, spray-on or sticky stuff, you know, that, like, pieces of tape, anything to help with that?
Well, yeah, go ahead. There are sticky things that you can put on the bottom of a bathtub. Joe, were you going to say?
Right, they're self-adhesive, and they're like little. They used to be flowers and things like that, which would be an option. Another option for her would be a shower chair, where she could, or shower bench, where she could sit, pivot her legs in, shower, and then pivot and get back out, so she doesn't have to necessarily stand in the bathtub if she had enough mobility to do that.
Yeah. So there's, I'm just kind of looking since you asked. So 3M makes a anti-slip tape, some kind of anti-slip tape that you can put in a shower. So it's clear. It's a high-friction, textured, slip-resistant material that you can just buy and put on the bottom of a bathtub. I do like the idea of the shower chair as well. That's a really nice thing to have, particularly as she gets older, or it's, you know, she tires when standing, just, or if she, you know, feels a little wobbly, she'll have it there to sit back on.
Right.
Okay.
And,
all right.
They're relatively inexpensive.
Yes. And I know, Lynn, that there are, companies that will put those in for you too, that will actually cover the whole bottom of your tub. And so it's, they come in different colors, I think. But, they work really well. I happen to have one in my tub, and it's nice. Doesn't move. So good luck, Lynn. Next up, we've got Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. So I'm in my early 70s, generally been fit, weigh 135 pounds. And prior to the pandemic and lock-in and all this stuff, I was doing like 15 to 20 pull-ups or chin-ups and at a time, and 50-some push-ups. And then for about a month when we were quarantined, I didn't do anything. And then I tried to resume them, could only do one pull-up, and then eventually got up to five or to six. But my left shoulder has had like an impingement, I guess, as a result of lack of the constant exercise and then resuming after a number of weeks. And it hasn't gone away. It's not super painful, but it's enough that I don't want to resume the exercise for fear that it won't heal. And when I do, I saw a little bit on YouTube some stuff about doing a exercise where you basically, you know, wave your arms in a big circle, either you using a Y or a T framework, but it actually sometimes I can feel in the left shoulder only a little bit of like something slipping over a bone or something like that. You know, I can feel a sensation of.
Okay, all right. Well, Art, what do you think, ladies?
Well, first of all, good for Art for doing those exercises. And then my best guess is when he went to resume them, that's a lot of load. Even if he weighs 135 pounds, but to do 15 or 20 pull-ups is a lot of load. So my guess is that he fatigued some muscles, and now going back to that same load is too much. I'm wondering if he needs to do a little bit of rotator cuff strengthening prior to going back to his pull-ups or his chin-ups. Lori, what were you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, my best guess is that he went back to it and he wasn't used to it and he just flared things up. So, yeah. So getting started on some rotator cuff exercises and working your way back slowly. Can you do some pull-ups at all now without pain, or do you get to a certain point and it starts to hurt?
Well, it hurts a bit even without doing it. So
okay, yeah, you're not ready to even start those yet.
So I would start with some rotator cuff exercises.
Yep.
Exercises, if you can get on YouTube and look for some rotator cuff strengthening with your arm down by your side, that would probably be the ideal thing to start with and get a little bit of strength going back in that shoulder, kind of recruiting the correct muscles before you start back with your chin-ups or your pull-ups.
Okay, thank you so much for that call, Art. We're talking with our regular physical therapists, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. What questions do you have for them? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And on the show tomorrow, we'll talk about the mental health challenges that you might be facing right now, from cabin fever to difficulty in focusing. And then at 11:45, we'll talk about DNA and ancestry and how you can participate in a virtual workshop. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. And right now, we're talking about falls and other physical therapy questions with our regular physical therapists, Jill and Lori. And we've got full lines, so let's get right back to them. First up is Christina, and she's calling from Glenwood. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I am wondering what your thoughts are on Z-Coil footwear. It's actually Z as in zebra, and then C-O-I-L, and it has an actual spring at the heel. I'm wondering, are there people that this would be beneficial for, and are there others that should avoid it?
So I'm looking it up right now because this is new to me, so thank you for bringing it to our attention. I'm guessing Lori is as well.
Yep, I am.
It looks like a tennis shoe with a spring in the heel.
Yeah. So let's start by saying that there's no research on it. So it hasn't been studied from a mechanical point of view to say it does this or it does that. So looking at them and just thinking mechanically, what it probably does is it probably functions to help with propulsion through the late phase of gait. Let me ask this, Christina, why would you choose to wear these? What is it that would encourage you to get this kind of a shoe?
Well, I had been talking to the people that were selling it, and that was at the Minnesota State Fair, and they were saying that it's very good on your joints and your low back because you don't have that pounding that you could when you're, say, walking or jogging.
Oh, so it's saying that it absorbs shock. So
at initial contact, that's what
So that's what they're saying. So typically, shoes are designed to absorb some load when your heel strikes the ground, and then that load is transmitted through your foot and out your big toe. I'm not sure how it changes when they place a spring in there. It will completely change some of the mechanics of your gait, not just at loading response, but at the end of your gait cycle too. So the thing is, when you're wearing a regular shoe and you land on your heel, it'll absorb some shock. And then as you roll through and you push off with your big toe, there's no propulsion from the back of your shoe. Whereas it looks to me like this is going to provide some propulsion, and I don't really know what the effect of that would be other than to potentially propel you forward somewhat.
I would almost be concerned about tripping.
Right.
Because it puts you, because of the demand or the spring on your heel, it puts you in what we call plantar flexion. So it kind of keeps you in this chronically toe pointed position, which is abnormal for gait or normal walking, number one. And then number two, I'm afraid if you wore them for a prolonged period of time, you would end up with some tightness in your calf muscle.
Right, exactly. So then when you went without them, you'd be in trouble.
Yes.
Yeah, at this point, I would not support use of these. Unless there's a specific indication for it. And the suggestion that this is going to decrease loads on your joint or decrease your pain in your back, there's no evidence to support that.
What would you suggest for Christina who, maybe for footwear if she wants to do that?
Right. So wearing just a well-supported shoe that has a good supportive heel counter and cushion is a good strategy. So, some people look at the back of their shoe and they say, oh my goodness, I must be walking funny because I'm wearing out the outside of my shoe before the inside of my shoe. That is exactly where you should be wearing out. You should, when you contact the ground with normal walking, you should be hitting on the outside of your shoe. So most shoes are designed to help absorb that with a nice, good heel counter. And then as Lori mentioned, the load should kind of roll through your foot and then ultimately you push off mostly through your big toe to kind of propulse yourself forward. And that's why the previous caller who talked about having arthritis in that joint, it can be very problematic. So looking for a shoe that fits you well, that is well supportive, and that you don't feel you need to quote unquote break in when you leave the store is a really good strategy. You know, we used to say, oh, you have this kind of foot, you need this kind of shoe. And research has really gotten away from that in shoe wear. It truly is. If the shoe feels comfortable when you're wearing it in the store, you don't feel like I have to quote unquote break it in, it's probably a good shoe for you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Christina. Next up. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, thanks for bringing that up, Christina. Yeah. It's always good to know about these things.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go to John in Sun Prairie. John?
Hi. Yes. I have a bicep injury. And that I got playing pickleball, and the pain is worse when I extend my arm straight out and then stress it, like if I pick up a pot of coffee or some weights or try to lift something. If I just hold my arm down to my side, I can actually do a light curl without any pain, and the pain is mostly at the top of the arm and also just a slight bit up like where the rotator cuff would be. And so my questions would be, will this heal on my own? And what treatment, if any, would you recommend? And I will say this. I did call a couple weeks ago when you guys were on, and when I asked the question, my questions, for some reason, Larry cut. He ended the phone call, and he never gave either of you a chance to answer my question. So I was So I was a little frustrated, and that's why I'm calling again. I didn't get my questions answered.
All right. Well, that's too bad. Well, you have described long head of the biceps tendinopathy perfectly well, I'd have to say.
Exactly. The long lever, when you reach out with that long lever, it's painful. But when you keep your elbow close to your side or you shorten that lever, it's much more manageable. So that sounds exactly like long head of the biceps tendonitis. And the pain is typically, like you mentioned, on the top of your shoulder. And it sounds like it's an overuse injury from playing pickleball, which would be the perfect mechanism of injury.
Yeah, so as an FYI, the reason you can do an elbow curl when your elbow is close to your body is that the long head of your biceps is not really much of an elbow flexor. It's more of a shoulder flexor. It functions more at your shoulder. At your elbow, you have the short head of the biceps and a couple other muscles that actually perform elbow flexion. So what to do about it? Well, we need to let it calm down a little bit. And are you still playing pickleball? Are you still trying to play?
I haven't played pickleball. It's been almost 2 months now. And what will happen is that I'll notice that it feels pretty good, and then I'll do something and lift my arms up a little higher and stretch it, and all of a sudden, oh, I realize, nope, that's still there.
Yeah. So this needs to be evaluated and you get set up on an appropriate exercise program for you. There are facilities. I can't remember where you said you were.
Sun Prairie. He's in Sun Prairie.
Oh, you're in Sun Prairie. So I believe at the American Center, they're starting to see people face-to-face. They're, you know, very cautiously. I think making an appointment to see somebody to get this evaluated and get on the right exercise program to get you going makes sense. You're missing your pickleball, which is an important activity, both physically and socially. It's not getting better on its own. I think you need some guidance in getting back to this. What do you think?
Me?
No, I'm talking to John.
Are you comfortable with it?
It will not heal on its own. No, your last 2 months is evidence of that. It's not going to just get better just with rest. I think you need some specific exercises, some things around your shoulder, some graded strengthening, probably some flexibility, probably some rotator cuff work. To get you going.
What I can say is I 100% agree with Lori, and I think probably getting you started with a one-time in-person visit, but then following up and progressing you via telehealth is probably a good strategy. And so if you think about the cost-benefit ratio of seeing someone, but the fact that this isn't healing on its own, I agree with Lori, it's time to see somebody.
Okay, thank you so much for calling back, John. Sorry we didn't get to those questions last time. It happens, folks. We're sorry. We try to do our best. We're talking about our regular physical therapists, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. We'll be back with more after this look at the news. Make sure you stay with us. Listening to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Our physical therapists are back with us. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And they're here to answer your questions about physical therapy. So give us a call. We do have an open line, first time in a long time. The number 800-642-1234. And of course, you can also send an email. That address is ideas@wpr.org. I'm not used to talking too much anymore, so I've got a little bit of a frog. But talking about email, Steve emailed looking for stretches or exercises to reduce the likelihood of encountering low back pain. He says he's 32, in good shape, and for the past decade, he has spent his days very active doing hands-on work like heavy lifting and falling trees by hand. He gets lower back pain every now and then, and sometimes out of nowhere, and sometimes feels something pull painfully when bending over or lifting things. It usually sticks around for days. Right now, on day 5, where it aches to stand upright and hurts more to bend. Sounds pretty familiar. What is going on? Any tips on how he can help himself?
Wow, where would one begin? So we would attack this on several fronts. So first would be getting at the cause of the symptoms. So it sounds like he has a very physical job.
Yep.
So talking to him about how he does his job. So he said something about it hurts to bend over. Well, we talk about bending and lifting mechanics. So squatting, you know, in a deep squat or a half kneel squat or a hip hinge bending rather than bending from the back, hinging at the hips depending upon what activity he's doing. Watching his mechanics if he's, for example, throwing ropes up in trees, looking at how he does that. So many times we see that people are strong, but they're not actually using the right muscles and the right mechanics when they're actually performing a task. So they'll bring them in, we'll check their muscles, and they'll have six-pack abs, but when they go to actually perform an activity, they're not engaging those wonderfully strong abs. So we look at how he does things. Then thereafter, we work on maintaining strength in the core, all the core muscles, hips, glutes, legs, lower abdominals, transversus abdominis, make sure he's recruiting everything. And then flexibility, specifically in hamstrings, because if your hamstrings are tight, your hamstrings will shift the load from what they're supposed to be doing onto your low back. And so the back ends up doing some of the workload of the hamstrings. And so we avoid that by making sure, A, your hamstrings are flexible, B, your back is strong, and C, you're using it correctly.
Right. So somebody like Steve, unfortunately, this is a challenging time to come in and see a therapist, but he's young and it sounds like he's planning on doing kind of a labor intensive job for some time. And it would be important to get him on a program that's really designed specifically for him, kind of hitting all those facets that Lori talked about, the flexibility, the strengthening, and then the mechanics of his job. And it would could probably be a visit or two to kind of make sure that he does those things correctly. But I think that's probably what he would be best suited for him at this point.
And yeah, he's young. He's got a lot of years to live
exactly.
with that back.
Yeah.
So if
yep.
he's having back issues that are lasting him 5 days,
yep.
It's only a matter of time before something fails. So my guess is however he's moving, he's overloading certain segments of his back. Other segments are being underloaded, and that overloaded segment is going to fail.
Yep. And what should he do right now with the one he has it? So
I would say, classically we do on your back some knee to chest stretching, single knee to chest, double knee to chest. We like doing a cat and camel. So if you imagine yourself being on all fours on your hands and knees, first arching your back up like an angry cat, and then letting your back sag the other direction as a general mobility exercise. And that should be done in a pain-free range. Some hamstring stretching, and maybe some gentle bridging, like on your back where you lift your hips up off the ground.
Okay.
And, yep, frequent, gentle, mild. So he should do these, kind of sprinkle them frequently throughout the day. So don't stay in one position for a prolonged period of time, kind of every 45 minutes to an hour. So move, change positions, try some of these interventions that Lori discussed. So you're kind of not in one position for a long period of time.
Good advice for all of us.
And walking tends to be good as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Again, we're all filled up. So let's go to Maury in Milwaukee. Hi, Maury.
Hi. I'm calling about falling in the bathtub or shower. What I do is I like to exercise in the pool, so I have water shoes, and I wear them in the shower.
That's a great idea.
I have a mobility disability, so I have to be very careful. So I use a shower stool, and then I wear the shoes, and they give that extra grip to help me navigate the bathroom.
That's a great idea. Thank you for sharing that.
Excellent. Yes, it certainly is a good idea.
Yeah, so... And that's nice if you're traveling somewhere. I mean, you may have good safety measures in your own shower, but if you're traveling, if you're visiting a relative, if you're staying in a hotel, having a pair of those for those situations makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it does.
Thanks,
all right.
Maury.
Yes, Maury, thank you. Next up, we have Chris in Spring Valley, Minnesota. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What can we help you with?
Hang on a second. I got to take you off speaker. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I thought of a better question. I'm 57, and I mean, really, I'm blessed, but I obviously don't do enough stretching and whatnot, but my feet in particular, I heard years ago an old guy told me to not ever skimp on your footwear, and I never listened to him. So I had these shoes that I thought had a lot of support, and I'd come in from the house, I'd take my shoes off, and within minutes, I get this pins and needles thing, I wore some shoes that were too tight for me that I didn't really like that much, and it seemed better. So I don't know what to do. Should I get some orthotics? I think I need to do less talking and more listening. But it's just awful. Anyway.
So say that again. You had shoes, and then you took them off, and you had pins and needles, and then did that go away when you took the shoes off?
The shoes I usually wear, they really feel good. Like when you put on new shoes at a store, you know, like you were talking, and these feel great. You know, I'm going to walk, all of these are going to be great. Well, some other ones that I had, because my feet are really big. They're about 13 and a half triple E. And I put some different shoes on because I got these other ones wet, and they're a little bit narrower, and they squeeze a little bit more. And I have broken my foot 20 years ago, so I have a big lump on the top of the right foot. So I think I had them a little loose. So I don't know, are they too loose? Should I get some pads? I buy these cheap dollar things from the dollar store, and I'm still skimping.
Do you have pain when you take the shoes off and are walking around your house barefoot? I'm wondering if it's the transition from being in a shoe to being barefoot. If he's a 13 triple E, Lori, it sounds like he's got really wide feet.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if just the lack of support walking around barefoot in his house might be problematic. He might need house shoes.
Yeah, I was having trouble following when it was getting, if it was numb only for a short period of time, suggesting that you're getting some pressure on your, some neuropathy while you're wearing the shoes because the shoes are too tight.
Metatarsalgia-ish, yeah.
Or even a little, yeah, Morton's neuroma or something on the top of his foot where he broke it.
Yeah.
Well, you keep using those big words, and I'm really going to have pain.
So is, you know, is
let me
pain,
be specific.
Go ahead.
The pain would start within a minute. Or say I go outside and I do my thing in my shop, and I go upstairs. I got these normal shoes I used to wear,
and your feet are fine. Okay,
my feet feel fine. You know, normal aches and pains. I take the shoes off within a minute or two. I can start to feel them kind of expanding or whatever. If I take my massager I've got with this little, you know, the one with the big long handle, it's got the two knobs, and I massage them, it feels really good. But if I do that within seconds after stopping that, it's just unbelievable pins and needles because I'm off my feet. When I started wearing the tighter shoes, it didn't do it.
Okay, so it must be that you need some sort of a house shoe. There's something about the lack of support and stability for your foot when you take your shoes off that is, it could be a tarsal tunnel, you know.
It could be.
Yeah, so there are a number of suspects, but for some reason when you stop wearing your shoes, you're placing pressure on a nerve that's giving you these pins and needles symptoms. So potentially needing to wear a shoe in the house. Do you have diabetes by chance?
No.
Okay. No. All right.
Good.
All right. Because it's not uncommon to get neuropathy in your feet if you have diabetes. So it could be, and is it just in one foot or both?
Neuropathy is the name for the pins and needles feeling I described?
Yeah, potentially, yes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And you feel it in both, is it in both feet or one foot?
Correct. Both feet.
Both feet. So, yeah, so I would keep an eye on this. You can also develop what's called peripheral neuropathy without having diabetes, and it's classically felt as pins and needles and loss of sensation in your feet. So I would try wearing a shoe around your house, get a house shoe or whatever, as Jill mentioned, to have support while you're in the house, and just keep an eye on it. And when you see your physician next, you may want to mention this and check and see if it is just an unexplained neuropathy or if it's related to the mechanics of your feet.
Okay. Thanks so much for the question, Chris. Let's go on to Jamie in Algoma. Hi, Jamie.
I was wondering if your guest could address the best way to assist a person who has fallen. I know our instinct is to yank them up off the ground right away. You don't like to see them on the ground, but I know if they're injured or if they haven't regained their balance yet, if they're dizzy, that's not always the best route.
It's a great question.
That is a great question. I guess the first thing would be to make sure that, I mean, you're always you don't want to move somebody who you suspect has a broken bone. So if you feel they've fallen and are in just really excruciating pain, I would probably wait for someone else to move them. I would probably call 911 and have somebody else move them. Having said that, oh, go ahead, Lori.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's kind of where I was going. Is I'd start with questioning them, you know,
right.
How much pain are you in? Are you alert? You know, sort of
right. The
standard triage kinds of questions. Do you feel like you can get up and so on? And then if not, you call 911. But if they feel like, oh, I just tripped or, you know, whatever, and they would like to get up, then the standard way to get people up, Jill, you can jump in, is you would, if they're on the ground, you would want them to move to their side, and from your side, push up to a sitting position. From a sitting position, you would want to go to what's called half kneeling. That's where you put one foot forward on the ground and your other knee is on the ground, and then stand up from there with minimal assist from you so you don't get hurt.
So the kind of the half kneeling position that Lori's talking about is the what I affectionately refer to as the "Will you marry me?" position.
Yeah. Oh, good. I
thought the same thing.
So that's what I call it, the "Will you marry me?" position. Those are all great options. The other option is if they are close to a stable piece of furniture, and they can crawl a little bit to a piece of furniture, they can push off a stable device to help them get up so they don't have to push off the ground. So the way Lori described it, you don't need another piece of equipment, which is fantastic. But if there's something very close by, something stable, you can certainly use that to push off of or lever off of.
All right. Great. Thank you so much for that call, Jamie. Appreciate it. Next is Carrie. Carrie is in Stevens Point. Do you have a question for us, Carrie?
I sure do. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling in regard to my husband, who is in his late 50s and lifts 30 pounds plus most of his workday. Last year, he was having back problems, so he had an x-ray on his back and hip area, and it showed arthritis. Well, now, I don't know if this is related or if we have a new dilemma here. He has intermittent daytime pain going from his groin down to his ankle and his left leg only, and at night, this actually wakes him up throbbing. He's tried Aleve, Tylenol, Advil, gabapentin they had him try. And we're wondering, should he be seeing a bone and joint person, a spine person, a vascular person? Any guesses as to where to start with this?
Oh, boy.
Well, it sounds like if he's on gabapentin, he's seen his primary.
That was actually from the spine person.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So we've seen a spine doctor?
He had last year for the lower back pain that was wrapping around to his groin area, and they told him to try it, but he doesn't use the gabapentin anymore. He said that Aleve or other things, if he just increases the quantities of those, work better than the GABA did. The GABA,
okay.
He said, didn't do anything, he didn't feel. But I'm wondering now with this throbbing at night, is that like veins vascular, or would that be, I mean, where do we start?
It could be vascular. It could also be kind of an extension of his low back pain going farther down his leg. But I think regardless of it, you need to get back in and see someone. And I would say if you've established care with this spine physician, that would probably be where I would start.
And
Lori, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. That was where I was going to go. So groin pain, so hip arthritis manifests primarily as groin pain.
Right.
But it tends to stay in the groin. It doesn't necessarily go down to the ankle. However, if he's in a fairly physical job, they don't always follow, you know, the pathway that we think they should. So groin pain can be a primary hip problem. It can be a low back problem. Once you get into the hip and low back, and if you talk to anybody who's had problems here, they'll tell you, you will get bounced between the hip person and the low back person, each one saying, no, it's your hip, no, it's your back. So as Jill said, I would start with the low back person. If it is vascular, it could also have some origins in his back, as in a claudication kind kind of a thing,
right.
Which would be a primary spine issue. So I would go there next, and I would go soonish and get this sorted out, because
exactly.
that level of pain on a Aleve or gabapentin that wakes you at night, that's not right.
Right, and progressively worse. I mean, she's yes. describing symptoms going farther down, things like
yep.
that. So yeah, I wouldn't, I would call.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Okay?
Okay. Thank you so much, Carrie. Let's go on now to Gary. He's in Madison. Hi, Gary.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thanks. Well, what's your question?
I'm very glad I'm getting hold of you. Okay, so for a long, long time, I've had this something that kind of seems to begin in my neck. It gets to my shoulder, left side. Then I get a dull pain in my left leg that kind of wraps around the front of my shin area. And then to alleviate the pain, I've kind of just figured this out. If I like bend over, raise my head up, and then stand up straight, it seems to go away.
Wow. So though anytime you have symptoms that start at your neck and go to your shin, we refer you to your physician.
Yeah.
Let me back up. The thing that connects your neck to your shin is your spinal cord. So if you're getting symptoms in your shin that are relieved by the position of your neck, you need to be seen.
Yeah.
Because there's pressure on your spinal cord somewhere.
Somewhere, yep.
And
it's
I would
chain.
Be seen
right.
sooner rather than later.
Right, right. Agreed.
Okay.
Yeah, I would not. I would, if you walked into my clinic, I would not treat you. I would refer you to your physician to get cleared on this.
Okay, so call your doc right away, there, Gary.
Yep.
Most doctors' offices are taking appointments these days, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. Our parking lot here at Research Park was full when I pulled in today.
Strange.
I'd make a phone call, Gary, and, mm-hmm. and get this sorted out. And it may not be much of anything, but it needs to be checked out to make sure it isn't anything. Okay.
Right.
Okay. And we did have an email from Ron. He wanted to ask if being more well informed about different types of canes would help prevent some falls.
Well,
okay.
I think the appropriate utilization of a cane and having the cane fitted to you appropriately, as well as the different type of cane recommended to you by a healthcare professional, is probably a good way to go. There are single tip canes. There are those things called hurry canes, which have some suction and some mobility in them. There's something called a quad cane. There's a narrow base quad cane, a wide base quad cane. So there's lots of different canes that serve different purposes. And the take home message for a cane is it gives you more contact with the ground. So it gives you another point of contact with the ground while you're walking. But what type of cane is recommended for you? I would still want that to come from a physical therapist. Lori, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. So I think you made the key point, which a cane does two things. One is it gives you a third point of contact with the ground. The second thing is it tells people around you to
yep.
give you wide berth.
Yep.
Because you have a cane. So they're less likely to come up and bump you, for example, on a crowded sidewalk, which hopefully there shouldn't be crowded sidewalks. But when sidewalks can be crowded again,
right.
it hopefully, you know, gives you a little bit wider berth. You cannot offload any more than 20% of your body weight with it. So it isn't designed to help take weight off a limb very effectively.
So that could actually cause more problems than... than not.
If you lean on a cane with too much load, yes.
If you need
a different assistive device, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. They'll be back to help you with your physical therapy problems by June 15th. And on the show tomorrow, we'll talk about mental health challenges you might be facing right now, from cabin fever to difficulty on focusing. And then at 11:45, we'll talk about DNA and ancestry. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.